This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, 2022 is finally coming to an end. And as we head into our final shows of the year, we wanted to revisit some of our favorite interviews of 2022. First up, my conversation with the political writer and commentator Wajahat Ali. I spoke to him back in February about his memoir that had just come out. It's called Go Back to Where You Came From and Other Helpful Recommendations for How to Become American. Ali, who was born in the Bay Area to Pakistani immigrants, told me that someone hurls that insult at him, go back to where you came from, almost daily.
There's usually two hallmark emails I get. Very lovely unsolicited recommendations. Number one is, go back to where you came from, you Arab. And I'm like, I'm not Arab. I'm a Pakistani stock. And do you want me to go back to the womb or Fremont, California? I would love to if you could subsidize the rent. And the second one I get all the time is, go F a goat or a camel. And I'm always just like slightly offended because they only choose goats and camels. And I'm like, there's a huge animal kingdom. Why only those two animals? I really want like a nerd listening. If you're a researcher, research why they're really fascinated with just those two animals. Like, it's never like a llama or like, you know, like a cat. It's goat and camel. So I get those two helpful recommendations almost on a daily basis.
So how do you just brush it off and find humor in that? It's pretty vicious and hateful.
Yeah, I mean, that's the title of the book, right? It's a gut punch, because many of us who are born and raised in this country, or many of us who consider ourselves American, are reminded almost daily that we don't belong, right? You're a suspect and an other in your own country. You're both us and them. And that those hateful words, they hit people differently, right? Some people just get triggered, and rage is perfectly fine, anger, sadness, tears, but I'm not one to cry. So you can either laugh or cry, and I choose to respond. And so oftentimes ignoring is a response, because life is too short. And if you respond to all the anger and hate, you know, racism gets exhausting. But sometimes I respond, like in the title, or like I just did right now, with humor. Because humor, I think, if deployed with intention, you can disrupt and flatten your opponent. You can booby trap those stereotypes. And also it allows for catharsis, a relief, and allows you to smile. And we need joy in life.
Yeah. Yeah. Aristotle knew that.
Yeah, there you go. Look at you, you nerd.
Going back to that. Well, I guess I'm wondering if you ever convince anyone, if you have people who are so racist and angry, do you ever disarm them successfully?
I don't know if I disarm them successfully, but what I do know is that they listen to me. You know, I've done this a lot my entire life, you know, for 20 years, especially if you're a Muslim in America in the ongoing and endless war on terror, you're asked to condemn violent acts done by violent people you've never met, and you're asked to prove your moderation in front of a very skeptical judge, jury, and audience that always holds you as suspect and indicts you and convicts you anyway. And so the bar is really low. And also when it comes to if you're Muslimy or Pakistani, they don't expect us to be like smart or funny or witty or know pop culture. I'm serious. They think we're like knuckle draggers who just discovered how to be bipedal. So if you come out and you speak English properly, and if you're not angry, and you could be funny, like literally people have told me, I'm not making this up, I'm talking about educated, liberal, Ivy League educated folks. There's one guy who once told me, I didn't know Muslims could be funny. And then he made this face. I'm like, why not? He goes, I always thought they were very, you know, very, I'm like, constipated? He goes, no, just like serious and sober. And so I feel like sometimes people like me are sometimes very threatening to folks because they can't dismiss us as an Osama or a Saddam. And oftentimes people like me can also help. I think if you use humor and you use bluntness and you engage folks in a conversation, what humor sometimes does is it releases endorphins, which scientifically has shown that people become more susceptible, Madeline, at least to entertaining otherwise hostile conversations, especially on politics and culture and religion, that they otherwise would not entertain. And that's where I can Trojan horse maybe a couple of gems.
But you, it is a funny book and a funny memoir in many, many places, but it's also not in many, many places. It's also very serious and filled with trauma. You write about almost dying a couple of times and the kind of curse on your family. Your family has also suffered a lot of calamities. And you write about how, as you said just earlier, how exhausting racism is and having to be, in your case, a representative of a model minority. And One line really stuck out in terms of that in one of your earlier chapters when you write, the system turns us into enforcers and defenders of whiteness, promising success and safety in exchange for loyalty and obedience. Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. It's the dangerous and toxic model minority myth in which you too can become American if you just bootstrap yourself and you smile wide with your white teeth showing and you don't complain and you're grateful and you nod along. And especially you Asians, you brown folks and those from China and Vietnam, you guys are the good ones. You came here, you worked hard, you didn't complain, and you have good spelling, and you get good credit, and you get a good job, and you get a good degree, and you're not white, and you know you're not white, but you get close to whiteness. And why can't these blacks and these poor browns and these other refugees just model themselves like you and stop complaining? See, you blacks and you browns, there's not a racist society, there's no white supremacy, this system works. Look at this Asian who's vice president, and look at this brown kid who got into Stanford. And then the model minority says, that's right, yeah, we're special, we're the good ones. See blacks and browns, how come you can't be like us? And that's how we cape for whiteness and we become enforcers of white supremacy, because we delude ourselves into believing this myth of the American dream, of exceptionalism, of bootstrapping yourself, of moderation, but there's a cost to it. We give up so much. We give up our voice. We give up our anger. We give up being the co-protagonist of our own narrative, the American narrative. We become sidekicks of our own narrative. We become invisible, and we're happy for it because we get close to whiteness and away from blackness. But the cost also is that we fail to realize that this country, no matter how hard you worked, no matter how white your teeth were, will turn on you on a dime overnight. It's not enough.
Which you discovered after 9/11.
I always knew it, right? But there's something about knowing something and reading about something versus experiencing it, correct? So I went to UC Berkeley. I was a 20-year-old, you know, the woke student at that time. I hate that word, but you know what I mean. Like, you know, educated, kind of liberal in your politics, but still, I think, a suburban kid who had a very lucky, privileged life, who went from high school then to UC Berkeley. And you read about this stuff, but you don't necessarily experience it. There's a difference between being a spectator and being an active participant in the American nightmare that is lived and experienced and not survived by many folks. And I remember it was the 9/11 terror attack that brought down the towers was the first baptism by fire for my generation, the turning point, where overnight, boom, Muslims and anyone who looked Muslimy was the target, right? Islam was the enemy, axis of evil, us versus them. And you're simultaneously both us and them. And then fast forward 8 months after the 9/11 terror attacks, my parents were arrested. And I leave school. I'm the only child. I have to take care of my grandmothers who are living with me. I have to take care of the family business. I have to find money for the lawyer. My parents are both incarcerated, and overnight realized, oh, this is the America that is lived and experienced by so many. I had 2 feet in 2 different islands, one in the American dream, one in the American nightmare. I had to navigate that schizophrenic reality for about 10 years.
Okay, well, let's talk about your parents being arrested, because they weren't arrested on any suspicion of terrorism. They were arrested.
Thankfully,
something else.
They were, yeah. So what happened was I was, 21 years old now. I was about to graduate UC Berkeley. I was about to go to law school. And my biggest decision, Madeline, was UC Davis or UC Hastings. And I was eating tandoori chicken at Shalimar in the Tenderloin. And I got the call from my aunt who said, your parents have been arrested today. I don't know what's happening, but you should come home and take care of everything. And my parents got swept up in something called Operation Cyberstorm, where I think about 27 people were allegedly part of this massive anti-piracy sting. But the irony is my parents had nothing to do with the counterfeiting. My parents instead had 30 counts against them for this previous work that they did where they sold educational software, Microsoft educational software. So my parents the night before were these, like, you know, upper middle class suburban parents chilling at home. And in the morning at 6 o'clock, like a dozen armed FBI folks came in, ran through the door, dragged them out of bed. And my dad said it was like, you know, he was like treated like a Mexican kingpin. They had no idea what was happening. And they read the counts and my father almost fainted. But what happened was both of them got arrested. And this was in the aftermath of 9/11. And you can imagine that there was immense fear in the Muslim community. People did not want to come near us, right? There was surveillance and there was conspiracy theories. And even in the pre-trial hearing, the U.S. attorney said, we have found books in Arabic, in Urdu. And do you know, they're from Pakistan. And the Taliban are also in Pakistan. And thankfully, the judge cut them off. So it was under that climate that this happened. And overnight, the money was gone, the assets were gone, community was gone. And my mom said it best, everything we touched turned to dust.
But you write that they made some pretty dumb and shady business decisions. They weren't on the level of a Mexican drug kingpin, but
No, in the book, I think I was very fair in the book in that I didn't defend them in the book, and I interviewed them, and they look back on some of the stuff they did, and they're like, yeah, I could see why that was stupid, but from my parents' perspective, and I mentioned this in the book, they didn't think they were doing anything illegal, and they had finished the business and moved on with their life. And like they were kind of confused as to what had happened. Does that make sense? It's like if you do something illegal and you know you're doing something illegal, you sleep with one eye open. And ignorance of the law isn't an excuse, but like they had literally moved on. This was like a business they did a year and a half ago. They had taken the money, started a new business, they were living their life. And then just imagine someone gut punching you. That's how they felt. And my parents, because they felt so innocent, or they felt like the 30 counts against them were BS, they made the decision and bad decision in hindsight. They're like, it's my name. Why should I accept guilt over my name? And I can empathize with them. So they decided to fight back and they appealed the case. And so for what happened is that case was in limbo for 9 years as they appealed the case. And there was like a sword hanging over our head, my head, for 9 years, because if they had won the appeal, hooray. But if they had lost the appeal, everything would turn to dust again. And as I mentioned in the book, they were initially in prison for a year. And then I finally got them out. They got out, they rebuilt themselves, they climbed back up, you know, the immigrant hustle. They got back in the house. I eventually went to law school. I became a playwright and a writer. We thought everything was going well. We're like, wow, this appeal's taking a long time. Maybe the courts are really considering it. And then right before I turned 30, they lose the appeal. Overnight, my dad gets arrested. My mother is given 6 months to report to prison. I lose everything again. I drive my mother to prison, which was very surreal. And the irony in was that everyone thought I was crushing it, Madeline. All my friends said, "You made it, Wajahat. You're the playwright. You're the writer." Meanwhile, I was homeless and living in hell,
Oh my gosh.
which was so weird. It was like the Twilight Zone episode from hell. Like, I didn't know if it was a comedy or a horror movie.
Yeah, it sounds awful, super traumatizing. And do you think that, well, had they not been, brown-skinned immigrants from Pakistan, they would have been dealt with much differently by the judicial system?
Yeah, I think so. You know, I mean, my parents definitely think that. They're like, you know, we were small brown Muslim fish after 9/11, and we didn't have the money, and we didn't have the right complexion or the connections, and they screwed us, and they made an example out of us. They being the U.S. government and Microsoft, right? And I feel like my parents, they're not bitter. If you read the book, you'll see that they have a, you know, they're very kind of have a clear-eyed, optimistic look on life. And the book also talks about their awakening, right? Like they were the model minority stereotype, but they go to prison, and my mom says, I noticed that most of my, you know, colleagues or inmates, I guess you could say, in prison, those who were incarcerated, were just, you know, women of color who just needed a second chance. They were just poor, and they were in there for drugs, and they were good women who just no one cared about them, and the system just ate them up. And in a strange way, it humbled them, but also gave them insight as to how racist and cruel the criminal justice system is, and how there's a double standard, and how being the model minority means nothing when you're automatically made into them overnight.
You end the book on a really hopeful note for yourself and for America. And there is this really beautiful passage you cite from the Quran that says, if the hour, the day of resurrection, is about to be established and one of you was holding a palm shoot, let him take advantage of even 1 second before the hour is established to plant it. What does that mean?
Yeah, plant a seed. Plant a seed. It means, you know, even if you see the day of judgment, plant a seed. Even if you see the four horsemen of the apocalypse riding and you have time, plant the seed. Do something with your hands to invest in something. Have hope. And I feel like sometimes that earned hope that I'm talking about is not that saccharine Hallmark, you know, ribbon Hollywood ending. That hope sometimes comes through pain, through scars, through acknowledging the warts, right? It's like you go through the forest and you survive the demons and you still keep standing. There's something about that that's very powerful. I'm still here. I'm still alive. I still have time. There's a pandemic that's flattened us unequally, but has flattened us. And I don't know what will happen in the future, but I've lived enough of this thing called life, and hopefully I've shown you enough examples that sometimes when you turn the page, it brings with it a plot twist. And the story doesn't have to end in misery. Sometimes your daughter does survive cancer. Sometimes your parents do get out of jail. Sometimes you realize you're not broken, and the pain and the wounds heal. And you have the scars, yes, but you also now have memories and experiences, and the pain can be replaced with joy. And just because your story began in a painful way doesn't mean it has to end that way as well. And I think that's the power of hope, and that's what we need right now. We need to invest in hope and joy, because we don't know what's going to happen in the future. But because the alternative, Madeline, is apathy and cynicism. And that means you have resigned yourself to being a spectator.
Yeah. I mean, if you're alive, you've got to do something, or it's too painful. We didn't talk about your daughter, but I do want to know, is she okay now? Your daughter was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer when she was 2 years old.
Yeah, my daughter was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer right before she turned 3, 8 months before the pandemic. The cancer went all over her liver, and she needed a full liver transplant. And initially, we had no idea if she was going to survive, because she had to endure every single, just type of setback imaginable. And thankfully, due to just people's kindness, I think I mentioned that story towards the end, because sometimes I said, sometimes some people can do good, right? I had people tell me, literally, quote, "I hate everything you tweet, but I'm praying for your daughter." I had people say, "I hate your politics, but I signed up to be a donor for your daughter." And I found out that over 500 people, mostly anonymous folks I'd never met, strangers, signed up to be a donor for this little girl they had never met, Nuseiba. And we finally got an anonymous donor who then outed himself, Sean Zahir, who stepped up to give a piece of his liver so another girl he had never met could live. And you go through that, and you survive that, and how can you not be hopeful? My daughter is alive. How can I not be hopeful?
And how is she? How old is she now, and how is she doing?
5 years old, cancer-free, knock on wood, sitting right now in virtual school in her dress, one of 3 costume changes of the day, with a ribbon in her hair. And I have been informed that I have to buy a very specific Encanto dress, the dress of the older sister, the one who makes everything into flowers. That's the dress she wants, and I have to find it for her. And if I don't find it for her, I might as well not come back.
Right. So she's basically saying, go back to where you came from if you don't give me that dress.
Yeah. Like, literally, if you do not give me this dress, what use are you, father? Just stay. Come home victorious, or come home on your shield.
That's author and political commentator Wajahat Ali. His memoir, which came out earlier this year, is called Go Back to Where You Came From and Other Helpful Recommendations for How to Become American. Coming up, we will have your weekend movie reviews, including the Avatar sequel.
The story and the writing is so awful that it almost diminishes the awe-inspiring beauty of all the visuals that James Cameron and his team has created.
That's next on Press Play.